From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Games. There's madness in the air, and it's kind of hard to breathe in here. Ahead on Only a Game, some of the latest college hoops action and a look ahead to the men's and the women's big dances. Also, should the men's field of 64 expand to 96, 128, 256? And the tale of Rick Hansen's circumnavigation of the globe in a wheelchair. Also, how Bob Feller, Satchel Paige, and Dizzy Dean integrated baseball before Jackie Robinson.
A lot of these games from the 1930s were played in places back in Jim Crow America where blacks and whites almost never gathered. And yet Satch and Diz brought these folks out together, black and white.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In yesterday's Southeastern Conference basketball tournament, Alabama hit the wall as Kentucky's John Wall led the Wildcats, ranked number two nationally, to a 73-67 triumph. In an Atlantic Coast Conference semifinal, Duke royally routed Virginia, 54-46, and oh my, Ohio State slipped by Michigan in the Big Ten quarterfinals, 69-68. At least one of the teams headed to the big dance has never been there before. Wofford College in Spartanburg, South Carolina, is the smallest school ever to make it to the NCAA tournament, with an enrollment just shy of 1,500 students. That's 1,500, not 15,000. Mike Young has been the Terriers head coach for 8 years. Coach Young, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
You've been on the coaching staff at Wofford for more than 20 years, but before this week, your team had never won a conference title or a regular season title or even a bid to the NIT. How nervous were your players as they took the floor for the Southern Conference title game on Monday night?
I don't know how nervous our players were, Bill. I know their coach was nervous as he could be. We thought enough was enough, Bill. So we won a regular season title and a tournament title all in the same year and got that stuff out of the way. And we'll look forward to going and representing our great college and our fine league, the Southern Conference, and this year's NCAA tournament. We'll do it with class, and we're fired up.
If I could get down to the campus instantaneously, would I see lists all over the place, sign-up sheets for bus rides to wherever this next game's going to be played?
I think we're a little premature there. There'll be a huge crowd Sunday for the selection show, and we'll all do that together. And then, you know, if we're in Jacksonville, you know, good luck to you. There'll be a Terrier van, caravan, you know, stretching from here to the Florida line of Wofford folks coming down. If we're in Milwaukee, who knows? That'll make it more difficult. But we'll have a nice following, you rest assured. We'll have a nice group with us.
Your Terriers had a great season, 15-3 in the Southern Conference, coming within one possession of winning at Pitt in the season opener, a slightly bigger school you played that night. Did you have the feeling all along that this was your year?
You know, we did. I've had that feeling since last year, to be honest. We were playing two freshman guards, two freshman point guards, two sophomore post players comprised our front line, three actually. We felt like we had the pieces in place to be really good. Now, that's all well and good. Do you have the other ingredients that go into, you know, making a championship team, the selfless attitudes? Are you going to get lucky enough to get through the year without one of your, you know, frontline guys going down with an injury? And we've had our share of problems with that here. And the answer to all of those questions has been a resounding yes.
I'm afraid the write-up from the Miami Herald is not quite as neutral as what ESPN put out there. Greg Cody calls Wofford's enrollment, quote, roughly the size of a University of Miami keg party and likens your chances to win your opening game to, quote, the likelihood Sudan would have won Winter Olympic gold in the men's halfpipe snowboarding. Is this the kind of thing you put up on the bulletin board before game one, see what happens?
No. I don't know who he is. I don't care. Bill, it's a great tournament. I think stories such as ours are a part of that. What we're doing here academically, I guarantee we're doing every bit as well, if not better, than Miami. I don't know who that person is. Don't really care. It's a great place. Our kids are excited. They deserve this. They've earned this. They're here for the right reasons. They're getting a world-class education. They've got great balance. They're students first. Our team has been over 3.0 grade point average in each of the last three semesters. Our team had the highest grade point average in the department last spring. So I'm not going to think another thing about you know, what clowns like that say.
So a player emails you midweek and says, "Coach, I got a big exam tomorrow morning early. Can't come to practice. That's okay?"
Oh, absolutely. Bill, I've got them running out of practice almost on a daily basis because they're going to study groups. I've got kids coming in late to practice because they're in labs. That's what we do. That's who we are. We finish our semifinal game against Western Carolina. We are one game away from playing in the NCAA tournament, one of the greatest moments in our school's history, potentially. And one of our best players, Noah Dahlman from Brand, Minnesota, comes to me at about 11:30 midnight, and he has a term paper due Monday, the next day, the day of the finals, that he has to email to his professor, and he says, "You always say our academics come first."
Brackets aren't released until Sunday, of course, but I think we can safely say that Wofford will not get a particularly high seeding. What do you think What do you think your chances are of pulling off an upset?
Oh, Bill, I'm not naive enough or dumb enough to make any kind of predictions. You know, I've heard some say we have a chance to be a 12. You know, we certainly played a great schedule. I think we could be anywhere from a 12 to 14. If we play a skilled team that's got a lot of size, that's not going to be to our liking. But I'll tell you this, Bill, we could give somebody heartburn because of our style. So we'll lay our ears back and give it our best shot and represent our college in a class fashion.
Mike Young is the head coach for the Wofford College men's basketball team. The Terriers find out tomorrow which powerhouse they will face in the opening round of the NCAA tournament. Coach, thanks very much for joining me.
Bill, I really appreciate you having me on. I hope you have a great day.
Tomorrow is Selection Sunday, the day when the field for the NCAA men's basketball tournament is set. Think it's tough following 65 teams every spring? Try keeping track of 96 squads or 128. It could happen. As Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports, the NCAA is considering expanding the tournament.
It may seem like it, but the 64-team tournament field was not etched into tablets on Mount NCAA in the ancient days of college hoops. In fact, in 1939, the first NCAA tournament featured 8 teams, and there have been several expansions since. The 64-team tourney debuted in 1985 after several years with a 48-team field. In 2001, the NCAA added a play-in game, bringing the total to 65. Miami Herald columnist George Cody believes the tournament is already too large.
To me, there was no compelling need to raise it from 48. I think there's a Cinderella fallacy connected to the NCAA tournament. The initial rounds are just the sort of the weeding out process where the charming little Woffords get eliminated and then we get on to the real basketball.
But after a quarter of a century without major changes, there's talk of making even more March Madness. The NCAA is reportedly considering an expansion to 96 teams. Why now? The association has until August 31st to opt out of its $6 billion, 11-year contract with tournament television partner CBS. That's led to speculation that the NCAA will take the option, expand the field, and negotiate a new agreement with one or more networks. More teams mean more games mean more TV coverage, and more TV coverage means more money. Most observers agree a 96-team bracket would mean the end of the National Invitation Tournament, or NIT, while making the NCAA tourney a week longer and giving the top 32 schools an opening round bye. Cody says that structure would allow teams that struggled to make the cut.
By the time you get that low, you're talking about teams that probably had a 14-12 record or a losing record in their conference. And why should teams that suffered through a very mediocre season, or in most cases a disappointing season, be rewarded with what should be one of the great grand national stages in American sports?
There's no shortage of people who agree with Cody. The talk of expansion has been widely criticized by columnists, bloggers, and fans alike. But there are some notable expansion supporters, including coaches who have won it all. Last week, Florida head coach Billy Donovan made his case for expansion on SI.com. And Syracuse head coach Jim Boeheim has been a vocal proponent of a bigger field for years. There are 347 Division I men's basketball teams, and during a recent appearance on ESPN Radio, Boeheim argued it's too tough to choose between the teams on the bubble.
I think the last eight teams that get in are going to look just like the last eight teams that get out. And to me, that means you need to have an expansion. Now, getting in the tournament doesn't mean that you can win the tournament. That's not the point of the tournament. If you only limited it to the teams that could win, you'd only have eight teams in.
Last week, Cornell University earned its third straight tournament bid, but it wasn't easy. The Ivy League's regular season champion gets an automatic berth, but it's the only league without a postseason conference championship, which could help sway the selection committee to add more Ivy teams. Although his Big Red might benefit from a larger bracket, head coach Steve Donahue is opposed to adding more entries.
To dilute it more, for a lot of reasons, I think is wrong. I don't think the public is going to be more interested in it. I think right now we have a great hold on the public, and it captivates the whole country. I don't know why we would want to change that.
Donahue's view of the tourney's popularity isn't far off. A Microsoft MSN survey found that 45% of Americans were planning to fill out brackets for NCAA tournament pools last year. In its annual report, the Chicago-based outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas estimates the 2010 tournament will result in $1.8 billion worth of wasted time at the office, including pre-tournament research and time spent watching opening round games during business hours. CEO John Challenger says additional teams and another round would only mean more reasons for people to spend time tracking hoops while they're on the clock.
People become so focused on this tourney and to get their picks right, they have a lot of research to do. So moving to 96 teams would mean a lot more homework and a lot less work being done. Just 1 week is costing $1.8 billion. I could easily see that doubling.
Given the popularity of the Big Dance and its history of growth, is expansion inevitable? In an interview with the Associated Press Tuesday, NCAA Senior Vice President of Basketball and Business Strategies Greg Shaheen said, quote, "Nothing is a done deal or decided at this point in time," unquote. But consider this. The 25 years since the last major expansion are by far the longest stretch without a substantial change. If you do participate in an office pool, a 96-team format would require picking 95 winners correctly to have a perfect sheet. But there's also one more pick you'll have to make, whether to put your brackets on two pieces of paper or start using a magnifying glass. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
But I don't care much for the question. Madness is all in the mind. Madness is all.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The cash machines in Moscow weigh 200 pounds, so it takes a big man to haul one out of a store. Last Friday, such a man did, in fact, make off with such a machine containing approximately 25,000 rubles, which sounds like more than the $838 to which it is equivalent. So, if you knew that the miscreant was an athlete, what sort of athlete do you suppose he'd be? A jockey? Not likely. Cross-country skier, perhaps? A diver? Nah. The fellow who hauled the cash machine off on his shoulders told police he was a professional sumo wrestler. Apparently fearless, they arrested him anyway. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the story of former Paralympian and current Canadian hero Rick Hansen. But first, on Monday, the NCAA will disclose its list of 63 thoroughly delusional women's basketball teams that will participate in the Big Dance. since none of them are UConn, none stands the proverbial Ice Cube's chance in Hades of winning it all. Here to talk about some of those teams and maybe even about whether I'm being totally unfair to some or all of the obvious pretenders is Michelle Smith. She's the national women's basketball writer for AOL Fanhouse and editor of LeftCoastHoops.com. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
UConn is unavoidable. They're riding a 72-game winning streak. This season, they're averaging 81 points a game. They're limiting opponents to just over 46 points per game. They beat Northeastern 105-35. They beat Seton Hall 91-24. I could go on and on. Is it unfair to suggest that the championship trophy should simply be awarded to Gino Auriemma's squad this weekend and everybody would be saved a lot of hassle, heartache, and travel?
Or the alternative plan is you tell UConn, thank you for playing, you're promoted to the WNBA, and then 63 other teams get to play for a trophy. You know, yes, they are very, very good, and they will be overwhelming favorites to win this tournament. But I'm not convinced that it's a shoe-in, and I may be the only one. But I have to say, I'm on the West Coast. I watch a team frequently that I think has a shot. I'm not saying I think it will happen, but I think that if there's a team out there that could do it, I think it's still Stanford. And I think even Nebraska, interestingly, I mean, a lot of people don't know a lot about Nebraska, but they are unbeaten as well. They are running through the Big 12 like the proverbial hot knife through butter, which is a very good conference. And I don't know how that would turn out.
Well, let's talk a little more about those two teams, because I agree with you. Those are the most likely teams to beat Connecticut. Nebraska is undefeated. Have they played anybody good enough to really test them?
Well, they've played in the Big 12, and Big 12 is very good. I'm at the Big 12 tournament in Kansas City, and the Big 12 is Texas and Oklahoma and Baylor and Texas A&M, and a lot of very good basketball teams, and Nebraska has beaten them all. They're not big. They're not huge. They don't have a ton of size, but they have five players who can score. They are very active on the defensive end. They have their hands on a lot of things. They're a very good team.
Stanford, the last time I looked, had only lost once. Are they better since their loss?
You know, I've been trying to put that loss into context and getting in trouble for it with Connecticut fans, but it was a December 23rd game in which Stanford, during that same week, had already beaten Duke and Tennessee, traveled across the country to Hartford to play on what was essentially a home court for Connecticut. They were up at the half and playing really, really well, and Connecticut turned on the jets, and they kind of ran away from them, but it ended up being a 12-point game. And you've got to assume, you know, you've got to assume Connecticut's better than they were back then, but you also have to assume Stanford's better. They need to upgrade their guard play for that game. And I've been telling folks that Stanford's guard play is good enough against everybody else in the country except Connecticut, and that will be where they would need to be better. But I'd be intrigued to see them play again, because I covered Tara Vanderveer for a long time, and you give Tara a second shot at anybody in the same season, and she's a meticulous scout, and it would be interesting to see how she would do, because Connecticut does so many things well.
We probably should mention at least one more team that has come through the regular season very successfully. They've only lost twice, and that would be Pat Summitt and the Vols from Tennessee. Any chance that they peak at just the right time? Have they got the person power to do it?
You know, I think Tennessee's going to go really far in the tournament. I think that the young team she had this last year is a year older. They're certainly playing a lot better. They came through the SEC, which, like the Big 12, was a bit of a, you know, a UFC cage fighting match for the entire year. And they came through with that. And this is a very good Tennessee team. This is not a great Tennessee team, in my humble opinion. But I see them making a long tournament run. But I don't know. They're not very deep in the post. If Kelly Kane, their center, gets in foul trouble, all of a sudden things get a little hanky. It's an interesting team for Pat.
Any other teams that we should be paying attention to in terms of possibilities of giving some of these front runners trouble early in the tournament?
You know, I mean, I think, you know, Duke is a pretty good team. Xavier's having a very good year out of a smaller conference in the Atlantic 10. They finished the season ranked in the top five, which apparently made their coach very uncomfortable. He doesn't think that, you know, he makes him nervous to be a top five team. But, you know, they've had a nice season. I don't know. This is an interesting year. I wrote last week that a lot of the brand name teams in women's basketball are good teams, but not as good as they've been necessarily. It's just for whatever reason that this is the kind of year that it's been, where teams like Duke and Notre Dame and even Tennessee and North Carolina and Maryland, and there are teams that have been at the top of the women's game for a while who are not quite as good this year as they've been. So it's, I think it's going to make for an interesting tournament. I think the rounds leading into the Final Four, there are going to be a lot of upsets and a lot of dogfights.
That's interesting that you talk about teams that have been at the top of the women's game for some years or close to the top, because, three, four, 5 years ago, people were talking about, you know, it's not going to be UConn and Tennessee on top alone forever. There are some teams coming into their own. And now we've got UConn looking so good. Are we going backwards here in terms of parity?
Well, Gino is landing the best players in the country year after year. The number one player in the country keeps ending up at UConn, and it's just almost a done deal. But I think cyclically or coincidentally, these are young teams this year. There's a lot of teams that are starting freshmen and sophomores and, you know, kind of starting over again. So I think it's just this kind of time, and it'll come back around.
Michelle, I know you've been paying a lot of attention to the conference championships. Have you a particular championship week story to tell us?
Oh, you know, it's not really over, though. I'm going to have to give some props to Alyssa Clark at Middle Tennessee State, who normally you would never hear of Middle Tennessee State, but she put up 40, 44 points, and then 48 in consecutive games in their conference championship. And the 48 points, she scored the winning basket in an overtime win to give her team the title. So, you know, what are you going to do? It's the highest scoring series of games in a conference championship in NCAA history.
Gotta hope they go deep into the tournament. They sound like they'd be fun to watch.
And scary for anybody that's got them on the other side of the bracket. If you're a major conference team and you're looking on the other side of the bracket and seeing Middle Tennessee State, you're not going to like that.
Michelle Smith is the national women's basketball writer for AOL Fan House and editor of LeftCoastHoops.com. She joins us from time to time to talk women's college basketball. Thanks again, Michelle.
Thank you.
The Paralympic Games are underway in Vancouver. Some 600 physically challenged athletes from around the world will compete in everything from sled hockey to wheelchair curling and alpine skiing. The Games also mark an anniversary of sorts. 25 years ago, Canadian Paralympian Rick Hansen went around the world in his wheelchair to raise awareness about people with disabilities. Only a Game's Sadie Babbitts has this profile of a Canadian national hero.
Rick Hansen's athletic resume reads like a fairy tale. 6 Paralympic medals from the 1980 and 1984 games, including 3 golds, numerous wheelchair marathon victories, and a place in the nation's Sports Hall of Fame.
Ladies and gentlemen, after a journey of 45,000 kilometers, the Olympic flame is entering the stadium.
More than 3 billion people around the world watched Hansen wheel himself through a cloud of fog and lights into the stadium during the Vancouver Games opening ceremonies. It's a moment, he says, that showed the values Canada holds about people with disabilities.
I believe we're a very accessible and inclusive society here in Canada. And, you know, what better way to demonstrate that than, you know, have someone who happens to have a disability but is filled with ability that can come into the stadium and be so filled with joy. And it was a proud moment. It was so overwhelming. I was just blown away by the experience.
But Canada hasn't always been accepting of people with physical challenges. Hansen learned that as an athletic teenager who dreamed about going to the Olympics. That changed after a week-long fishing trip. He and a friend were trying to get home, so they hitched a ride in the back of a pickup truck when the driver lost control.
The truck flipped over, and I was on the inside of the roll, and it threw me back first against a big steel toolbox and snapped it like a twig, and my spinal cord was damaged, and I couldn't use my legs. And you can imagine how devastating that was at the age of 15.
Hansen remembers being angry and then slowly learning to deal with his new life. He took up wheelchair basketball, and he started doing marathons. The marathons got him to the Paralympics twice, where he won medals. And in 1984, Hansen was one of the athletes to demonstrate wheelchair basketball at the Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. Even with all his success, Hansen says people didn't know how to act around him.
I would be wheeling past them on a hill as they'd be walking briskly, and they would look up and see a guy in a wheelchair, and they'd pick up the pace and run as fast as they could, out of breath at the top of the hill, and say, "Excuse me, sir, can I give you a push?" I'd look at them and I'd say, "No, but you look tired. You know, you want to sit in my lap, I'll give you a ride."
In 1976, he was denied entrance into the University of British Columbia's physical education program. How could someone in a wheelchair teach sports? But Hansen proved them wrong. That first year, he took general art and science classes and reapplied for physical education after he demonstrated his abilities. He became the first student with a disability to get a UBC degree in physical education. Once he had that degree, he set off on the ultimate marathon. Hansen decided to wheel around the world.
At that time, in the 80s, it was often thought of to be difficult to go across the street on your own in a wheelchair, let alone to be able to wheel around the world. We wanted to be able to, you know, shock people to think, wow, you know, that can actually happen.
In the spring of 1985, Rick Hansen left a parking lot in Vancouver with 200 people cheering him on. His goal was to raise $10 million for spinal cord injury research through his Man in Motion World Tour.
I mean, we didn't have enough money to get past Texas, you know, the first 2 months of our journey when we left. And we didn't have every route completely identified, every I dotted, every T crossed on the logistical side. But it was a two-year journey, and we needed to start.
By the time he reached China, he was wheeling through thousands of cheering fans. Hansen made it to the Great Wall of China. He had to be carried up the stairs. Then he rolled up to the wall's highest point.
It's so symbolic. It's symbolic of what man can do when he believes in something, when he works together as a team, and of course perseveres over time. And that's what our tour is all about.
After 2 years on the road, battling the worst weather, sickness, and injuries, Hansen returned to a hero's welcome in Vancouver with 50,000 fans cheering him on. He'd traveled the circumference of the globe and raised $26 million for spinal cord injury research. Mike Reed was part of that Man in Motion tour.
The tenacity to be able to get into that chair every day, 3 days on, 1 day off, and wheel the equivalent of three marathons with just the use of his arms is amazing. It's I think, the single greatest physical feat that's ever been accomplished.
For Hansen, it was simply a matter of sharing his abilities with the world.
I was inspired to try to do something to give something back and take my talent in marathoning and set out on an impossible dream, try to wheel around the world to shatter attitudes and perceptions and to try to show the world what was possible if you remove barriers that didn't have to be there.
Rick Hansen is now 53. He focuses most of his time on his foundation and overcoming the biggest barrier yet, a cure for spinal cord injuries. On March 21st, the day the Paralympics end, he'll set out on a new world tour, this time by airplane, to get countries on board with a new global initiative to work for a cure for spinal cord injuries. Fittingly, Hansen's journey begins 25 years to the day he launched his Man in Motion tour. For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
If you'd like to leave a comment about something you heard on Only a Game, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. Our story last week about women who have successfully competed with men and other women who are being prevented from competing with each other at the Olympics, namely the ski jumpers and potentially the hockey players, drew several comments. Richard Galgano opined at onlyagame.org as follows. With respect to IOC President Jacques Roga's contention that women's ice hockey shouldn't be an Olympic sport because of lack of competition, if this logic is true, Olympic men's basketball should have been eliminated immediately after the first Dream Team. We received several emails in response to that story as well. Mandy Ranslow, who downloads our podcast, wrote, I really enjoyed last week's segment on the separation or not of men and women in sports. I'm a professional miniature golfer, and there is no gender separation in our tournaments. I really enjoy competing against men and women on an equal playing field, or more accurately, an equal putting green. Meredith Davey, a WBUR listener, expressed thanks for the story and wrote, I am discouraged at the increase in baseball's gender separation over the years. A century ago, female semi-pro ball players were common in barnstorming bloomer leagues, which were often co-ed. Rogers Hornsby got his start on such a team. John Wild, who hears the program on WEPR in Greenville, South Carolina, enjoyed my conversation with Alexander Wolf about the 1950 World Cup game in which the U.S. upset England. He wrote, some University College London students with whom I studied in 1956 ranked that game up there with the loss of the Empire as one of the benchmarks of post-World War II British decline. They could not believe I had never heard of our triumph, even after I told them hardly anyone paid attention to soccer in the U.S. They couldn't believe that either. Mary Frechette, who hears Only a Game on KWMU in St. Louis, wrote to finish the conversation I had with Charlie Pierce last week about how Mark McGuire Highway had been renamed for Mark Twain. Ms. Frechette wrote, I just wanted to let you know that the highway in question was the Mark Twain Highway until 1999, when, in our giddiness over Mark McGuire, we changed the name. So it was originally, as you suggested, it should be. You can contact us at facebook.com/onlyagameradio. You can follow us on Twitter, username onlyagameradio. And, of course, you can always reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Oh, Canada, glorious and free. How often did that anthem ring out over the hills and the valleys and the rinks and the runs of Vancouver? Why, 14 times, as it turned out, and that was enough for some legislators in Ottawa to start wondering if the line, true patriot love in all thy sons command, was sexist. A spokesman for Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced an offer to listen to Canadians regarding whether the line should be changed, and nearly as one, the citizens said no, except for the ones who said no. And so if Canada wins a bunch more gold medals at the Summer Games in London or perhaps the next Winter Games in Russia, sons will endure, even if the medal winners are daughters. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, barnstorming and the greatest baseball team of which you've never heard. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for Look the Week's News. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Selection Sunday is tomorrow, and when next we meet, the first losers in the men's NCAA basketball tournament will have staggered home in disgrace, except for the ones who were just happy to be there. You want to skip ahead and just give me the final four?
I can do this now because they haven't set up the regionals yet, so none of what I said will matter. I believe Kansas will be in the final four. I believe that Kansas State will be in the Final Four. I believe that Syracuse will be in the Final Four. And I believe that Baylor will be in the Final Four.
So you think Syracuse will overcome the mighty only a game jinx? Because they've been lousy since we talked about them.
No, that's absolutely right.
The NCAA is currently facing a lawsuit, Charlie, contending that college athletes should have been paid when their images were used by the NCAA to generate profits. If the plaintiffs prevail, how might the nature of college football and basketball change?
Oh, I have been waiting for this one for years, because this was the thin edge of the wedge that was always going to blow up the system of undercompensated free labor that is the NCAA. This is about Ed O'Bannon, the basketball player who used to play at UCLA in the 1990s. He's arguing that his image was used as a likeness on a video game, and it pretty obviously was. And it's pressing the point of exactly how much of your life do you purpose away when you sign your letter of intent to play college basketball. The suit has already gotten the NCAA to open its books, which is a big step in the right direction. And, of course, the one thing everybody realizes is if the current system collapses, there's nothing to take its place, because everybody who's told the NCAA for years, you ought to make adjustments so that when it finally happens, you'll be ready, was ignored. This has the potential to be the neutron bomb of college sports.
Okay, pro basketball quiz. Orlando Magic coach Stan Van Gundy was asked this week to comment on a decision reached by another NBA team, and Van Gundy said, quote, "It's just hard to comment on anything another organization does because you don't know why or how, and multiply that by about 10 with which team did the coach insert?"
Well, I mean, this is an obvious answer. This is the Los Angeles Clippers, who fired Mike Dunleavy as general manager a month after he quit as coach so he could spend more time being general manager. It is time for the Clippers to take up stakes and move to the land of happy sparkle ponies, because they're simply not going to have any good luck in Los Angeles.
On Sunday, Matt Cook of the Penguins hammered Mark Savard of the Bruins toward the end of their game in Pittsburgh. Savard was knocked out. He left the ice on a board, and the concussion he suffered may have ended his season. Would the NHL's general managers have voted unanimously on Tuesday to punish hits like that, even if Matt Cook hadn't mugged Mark Savard on Sunday?
I don't think so, but the whole thing has been preposterous. Cook should have been suspended for the season on the spot. The NHL is pretending to be a major league again and falling on its face the way it does, so Colin Campbell needs to be fired. Gary Bettman needs to look in the mirror, and something needs to be done, because otherwise people are going to start taking things into their own hands, and that's going to be really ugly. If the NHL really wants to be a professional major sports league, it's got to cut this stuff out.
Meanwhile, on the same day, NHL enforcement chief Colin Campbell declined to punish Cook for that hit, saying he couldn't break precedent, meaning...
Well, they apparently hadn't punished Mike Richards for doing roughly the same thing last year. I don't know what has to happen. Does a guy have to get paralyzed? Does somebody have to die before Colin Campbell gets off the dime? I don't want to hear it from these people anymore. There's a reason why your sport has fallen behind golf and NASCAR. And 2 weeks ago, all anybody could talk about was what a beautiful game ice hockey was. And the NHL has now blundered in its blundering fashion and wrecked all that PR.
All right. Major League Soccer players say that they will strike if a new labor agreement isn't worked out before the season opener on March 25th. The league says it's in no hurry to negotiate further. So it looks like on March 25th, I will fall into a deep and lasting depression. Are you ready to take over as host while I'm recovering?
If a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, does it really make a sound? The players are saying they're going to go on strike, and the owners are saying, we don't care. Okay, fine.
Reacting to news that police in Georgia are investigating claims of sexual assault against Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger, LA Times columnist Bill Plaschke had this to say this week, quote, "At worst, he's a criminal. At the very least, he's an idiot." What do you think? Would you agree?
It's hard to argue with the second part, even if he isn't a criminal, because what's he doing cruising college bars at his age with his posse? This is a guy who, after his glorious rookie year, rode his motorcycle into a limo. This is a guy who's had this charge lodged against him before. If you have to go to a bar, go to a nice, quiet neighborhood place, okay? Don't be cruising the college strip in Milledgeville, Georgia.
Charlie Merlin Olsen died this week. He was a Pro Football Hall of Famer, one of the L.A. Rams' fearsome foursome, an NFL broadcaster as well, and he played Jonathan Garvey on Little House on the Prairie. I think he sold flowers
for a while. First of all, Merlin Olsen was a terrific football player. The fearsome foursome, of course, you can name all four of them, of course, Bill, so I won't make you do it right now. Lamar Lundy, by the way, is the one nobody ever remembers, which is too bad because he's the only alliterative one. He was, however, Merlin Olsen, the least likely FTD spokesman in the history of the world.
Charlie, just when you thought Chad Ochocinco of the Cincinnati Bengals and the Ochocinco News Network couldn't top his Dancing with the Stars bid, he has taken on yet another television venture. What is the tournament, and will you be tuning in?
He's going to look for a leading lady of his life, according to the World.
This isn't even an original idea.
Do you think that, like, the executives at the Cincinnati Bengals just have their palms permanently glued to their foreheads at this point? Because not only is he embarking on this venture, but in his other reality show debut, which is Dancing with the Stars, he's developed a crush on, wait for it, Kate Gosselin. Ochocinco and Kate plus Ocho.
And finally, Charlie, ESPN Films is planning to make a movie about the life of Vince Lombardi. Apparently, Robert De Niro will play the lead role. Brilliant choice.
I love this casting. I really do. I mean, was he going to have to gain a little weight? Well, we saw Raging Bull, right?
He managed to do it for Jake LaMotta.
I think the level of ferocity for, you know, getting it, you know, and big props to ESPN Films for landing Robert De Niro. I think it's a great choice, and I will actually go see this movie. I hope that they're going to be filming on location in Green Bay, because once you've gone to Green Bay, you know, Hollywood people may never leave.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me here each week at this time as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Ask most people the name of the first black man to play baseball with and against major leaguers, and they'll tell you Jackie Robinson. And they will be wrong, because decades before Robinson joined the Dodgers, a host of Negro League players were regularly barnstorming with major leaguers who wanted to make some extra money and knew the show would draw paying customers of all colors. Three of those men are the subject of Timothy Gay's most recent book, Satch, Dizzy, and Rapid Robert. Timothy Gay joins me now from NPR in Washington. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, it's great to be back with you.
Satchel Paige, Dizzy Dean, and Bob Feller, a.k.a. Rapid Robert, were all superb pitchers. Were they all superb promoters and businessmen as well?
Yeah, I think they all had an intuitive genius for marketing and promotion. Even Satch and Diz, who did not have much schooling in their background, both had a real feel for how to promote themselves, and they were shameless about it. Feller, ironically, years later, who had a stronger academic background and a real fascination, educated himself as an MBA. He's the guy who brought a lot of corporate thinking to baseball and really opened up baseball's eyes about how best to market themselves.
The ball games, of course, were not literally played in barns, but they were often played in fields and pastures where temporary bleachers were set up rather than in stadiums.
Oh, that's absolutely right. A lot of these games, especially the Dizzy Dean Satch Paige games from the 1930s, were played in tiny ball yards in tiny towns throughout the Midwest and Great Plains. Places like Oxford, Nebraska, Enid, Oklahoma, Joplin and Columbia, Springfield, Missouri. Places back in Jim Crow America, Bill, where blacks and whites almost never gathered in any kind of public venue, and yet Satch and Diz brought these folks out together, black and white.
Well, you discovered that when Dizzy Dean and his brother Paul, also a Cardinals pitcher, barnstormed, they played against teams composed of black players about two-thirds of the time because it was, as you write, quote, a proven crowd pleaser. Were those crowds pleased no matter who won?
I think on balance they were. I think black fans, when they turned out and often had to sit in the harshest Jim Crow settings imaginable, either relegated to standing room or some distant pavilion, I think they rooted very hard for the black guys. And often Satch, whether he was playing with the Kansas City Monarchs or playing with some kind of all-star Negro League contingent, Satch often won and wanted very much to please the black fans. Paul and Diz had the disadvantage, Bill, of playing usually with sandlotters or with local minor leaguers or with whatever major leaguers they could scrape together. They didn't normally play with a team nearly as tough or competitive as the team that Satch was able to field, and the results reflect that.
From the outset, Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis opposed these exhibitions. Was that because of his personal racism, or did he really feel that these exhibitions were bad for Major League Baseball?
I think a big part of it is both, but the biggest was the opposition that the club owners threw Landis's way. They were very concerned that barnstorming in October would detract from the World Series. And early on, one of Landis's charges from the owners who paid him his salary was to do his best to eradicate barnstorming. He tried many different ways over the years, as did his successors, as did the president of the National League and the American League back then, but none of them succeeded.
These games were exhibitions, of course. How did you go about finding any records of who had played in them, let alone evidence that Satchel Paige had struck out major league hitters or that Josh Gibson had hammered major league pitching?
Well, it wasn't easy, Bill. For the most part, the mainstream press ignored this. Fortunately, the Pittsburgh Courier and the Chicago Defender and other great African-American newspapers of the day did cover it erratically, sporadically, but they did cover it. Out on the West Coast, fortunately for historians, the Los Angeles Times and the old Los Angeles Herald and Express, they were so thrilled to have major leaguers in their midst that they tended to cover these interracial games a bit more aggressively than the mainstream media. So the West Coast games, at least, we've got a pretty good record of.
You celebrate one particular game in Los Angeles in the fall of 1934. This is a game that Bill Veeck, who hired Satchel Paige to pitch for the Cleveland Indians 14 years later, called the greatest game I ever saw. Tell us about what made that game special.
It happened in early November of 34. Dizzy and Satch supposedly went head-to-head that night. Satch struck out 17. Dizzy struck out 15. They went 13 full innings, you know, chucking up goose egg after goose egg until finally in the bottom of the 13th, the black guys finally scored a run against Dizzy and everybody went home well after midnight.
When people talk about history's best baseball teams, the 27 Yankees come up, as do the 75 Reds. Make the case that the best team most people have never heard of was the Bismarck Capital Citians.
1935, the Bismarck Capital Citians were a fine semi-pro team that tended to dominate the semi-pro circuit up in North Dakota. A guy named Neil Churchill, who was a cutthroat Chrysler car salesman, decided he wanted to hire great Negro leaguers to augment his already formidable white lineup. He not only got Satch, he not only got the great Ted Double Duty Radcliffe, one of the great catchers of all time and a fine pitcher in his own right, but later in the season, he got the great Hilton Lee Smith, now a Hall of Famer, Chet Brewer, who should be a Hall of Famer, and a couple of other very prominent black ballers. These guys not only dominated all summer long, all the competition that came up to Bismarck and where they went, you know, barnstorming throughout the Dakotas and Canada. They went up into Saskatchewan and Manitoba. Then at the end of the season, they went to the brand new semi-pro national championship tournament in Wichita, Kansas, and completely dominated the best semi-pro teams brought from all over the country. It's just a wonderful moment in social history.
There were some arguments during some of these games, of course, and there were some racial incidents connected with some of the games as well. But for the most part, no matter who won, a good time seems to have been had by all. Why didn't the success of these exhibitions, particularly the ones where black and white men were playing on the same team together, encourage the integration of the major leagues well before 1947?
I think it has everything to do with just how deeply racism was rooted in our culture, the way Jim Crow had everybody by the throat back then. It's the saddest thing, Bill, because especially the experience of the Capital Citians in the Dakotas and all the wonderful games that took place out on the West Coast should have opened Major League Baseball's eyes to the amount of money that could be made. Branch Rickey certainly understood. Bob Feller certainly understood. But it took far too long before the rest of the baseball establishment could be brought along.
When he was arranging barnstorming exhibitions with Satchel Paige and with various promoters, white and black, Bob Feller always maintained that the best Negro leaguers would have been successful in the major leagues. At what point did he begin backing off the stance that had caused lots of people to regard Feller as a champion of integration?
It's very curious. He was not only a champion of integration, but a champion of player rights and a very early and lonely pioneer for the dissolution of the reserve clause in baseball in the 1950s. But I think as the years got on, his politics drifted rightward. And for whatever reason, he began having second thoughts about the role he had played in all that. It's a shame because, in my judgment, it's one of the most important parts of his legacy.
Timothy Gay is the author of Satch, Dizzy, and Rapid Robert, The Wild Saga of Interracial Baseball Before Jackie Robinson. He joined me from NPR in Washington. Tim, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it was my pleasure. Thanks.
Dizzy Dean, oh, Dizzy Dean. He was the best damn flame-throwing pitcher that you'd ever seen. He was a spark-plug of the gas house gang. He tried to strike out every man in the league. Dizzy Dean, oh, Dizzy Dean.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Tyler Murray. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from John Challenger of outplacement consulting firm Challenger Gray and Christmas, who admits he just might fill out his brackets on company time.
Yeah, well, I probably will have to do a little of it, certainly some of it during the work day.
Man, I hope Mr. Challenger doesn't get caught and then outsourced. I say, I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.